So Sam, you have a very rich CV. Please take us quickly through your background, starting with your name, and tell us how you arrived at sounding the alarm about biological research, which culminated in your piece in Salon.
My name is Sam Husseini. I'm an independent journalist. A lot of my writing is at Husseini.org. I did a lot of work regarding claims about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction before the invasion of Iraq, and indeed throughout the 1990s about false claims demonizing Iraq and false claims about the existence of Iraq WMDs. And I occasionally go to news conferences and ask tough questions. In 2011, when the Arab uprisings happened and the desire for change was being perverted by Saudi Arabia and other governments, I questioned a Saudi official at the press club, asking him what the legitimacy of the Saudi regime was. I got suspended from the press club for that, and that was later overturned by the ethics committee there. In 2018, I attempted to question Trump and Putin at their summit in Helsinki about the nuclear weapons ban treaty, and got dragged out.
And when protesting there?
It looks like there's some...
Oh, protesters?
What is this, fisticuffs?
Some sort of a skirmish. Someone
what
was holding
heck?
Up a sign.
Last year, I covered the Plowshares trial in Georgia of activists who went on a U.S. main Trident military nuclear base. So I followed nuclear issues, other weapons of mass destruction issues, politics in general, but especially foreign policy.
How did you get to the article that you wrote in Salon? What inspired you to write it?
On February 11th, the CDC had a news conference, or the press club had a news conference with a CDC official. And I try to go to these things and try to ask what, as best I can, a tough question, sort of the question that's, you know, the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. And I asked about the lab in Wuhan.
Sam Husseini from Consortium News. Obviously, the main concern is how to stop the virus and death and so on. But I think that we should look into the origins of this. Is it the CDC's contention that there's absolutely no relation to the VSL4 lab in Wuhan? It's my understanding this is the only place in China with a VSL4 lab.
VSL4, that's the highest level lab with the most deadly pathogens and allegedly the most stringent safety requirements.
We in the United States have, I think, two dozen or so. And there have been problems and incidents. Some of them have been shut down out of concerns of leakage of potential pathogens. And it's an ethical struggle in the United States about gain-of-function research. That is, research that actually attempts to make pathogens more lethal. And China is a very opaque society, a totalitarian regime. We have no idea, or I don't know, you tell me, do you have any idea what kind of research could potentially be done? I'm not contending that this was intentional in any way. I'm just asking, is it a complete coincidence that this outbreak happened in the one city in China with a BSL-4 lab, and shouldn't we be having at least some of the discussion about the ethics of some of the research that happens here? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. Based on everything that I know about what is going on with this outbreak and the research that's being conducted, as well as the genomic sequences that have been posted and the comparison with animal strains, the pattern that we're seeing is quite consistent with emergence from animal to human acquisition.
I followed up and I said, being of quote-unquote natural origin doesn't necessarily preclude that it didn't come from the lab. That is, they could have collected it in nature. The caves, the bat caves that people point to are over 1,000 miles away from Wuhan. And she had the most striking response to me, which I've heard elsewhere.
In the midst of new infections, it is very common for rumors to emerge that can take on a life of their own. So as you mentioned, a laboratory and the center of what else is happening in that province, I'm reminded of concerns we heard when I was in Sierra Leone in 2014 with the Ebola response. There was a concern that there was a hemorrhagic virus research center in Sierra Leone, and maybe that's where the virus had come from. It was a key rumor that had to be overcome in order to help control the outbreak. So based on everything that I know right now, I can tell you the circumstances of the origin really look like animal to human. But your question, I heard.
It struck me as an incredibly defensive answer meant to shut down a legitimate line of inquiry rather than a forthright answer.
In terms of the question about gain-of-function research and laboratory issues, very important for us as a scientific community to have practices that protect researchers and their laboratory workers as well as the community around them, and that we use science for the benefit of people. So I am closely involved in this response, and everything that I've seen so far is very consistent with the animal-to-human spread that we've seen in other zoonotic origin.
I was still focusing on the narrow questions about the election at that point, but I started digging further and further into it, and it culminated ultimately with my first Salon piece.
We are being generally assured from many quarters that there's no reason to believe this virus is anything other than a quote-unquote zoonotic pathogen from a food market in China. Others, including U.S. administration officials recently, have hinted at the possibility that this was an accidental release from a lab in Wuhan. Is there any reason to be confident that these are the only two explanations?
I don't think those are the only two explanations. I think that there are three plausible explanations, and I think that people making claims on different sides might have ulterior motives. And I wouldn't believe the Wuhan lab explanation simply because government officials say so. That to me does not necessarily increase the veracity of that explanation.
You don't have a particular interest in pinning this on China, right? You don't think this is like an actionable thing, we should be going to war with China. You're not arguing that.
Not at all. I think that many people who are saying things like that, primarily in the U.S. right, like Tom Cotton, but also Democrats as well. Chris Murphy put out a letter basically fingering the lab in Wuhan. And when Cotton does it, it's particularly vociferous and talking about the secrecy of these Chinese labs and how dangerous they are, and explicitly saying how, in contrast to our labs, which are open and trying to create vaccines to benefit humanity and so on. And I think that that's totally wrong. The lab work that's done, this kind of lab work is dangerous, whether it's done in a Chinese lab or a U.S. lab. And indeed, the U.S. policy has driven this arms race. I mean, it's possible that China, the Chinese lab slipped on a banana peel here. But in part, they slipped on a banana peel in a race that was orchestrated by U.S. policy. As I see it, there are three explanations. One is it had nothing to do with a lab, which I hesitate to say came from nature, because that could mean that ultimately the causes are animal farming, deforestation, and so on. But just broadly say that had nothing to do with any lab. The other is that it was an accidental release from one of the labs. There are actually two. I didn't know that when I questioned the CDC initially. There are two labs in Wuhan, an accidental release there. And those accidents happen, including at U.S. labs. It's a long and documented history that I at least, give a rough outline of in my recent articles. And the third one is that it was designed to, in effect, frame the labs in Wuhan. This would be akin to what happened with the anthrax attacks. People might remember after 9/11, letters were sent in the mail with, death to America, praise to Allah, written on them to members of Congress, to members of the media,
It sent a wave of panic throughout the United States. People were afraid to open their mail. It made people incapable, in many cases, of rational thought as to what threats did or didn't exist. And they ultimately were traced, to the extent that they were fully traced, to U.S. or U.S. allied labs. That is, the anthrax, the terrorists, came from within the U.S. government. So that's what you would call an example of a false flag attack. It's a very prominent one. It was never meaningfully resolved. Even Leahy, Senator Leahy, one of the targets of it, Mueller was head of the FBI in 2008, and when they finally said, you know, okay, we pinned it on this guy, Bruce Ivins, after they've tried to pin it on several other lone wolves, and had to pay one of them off millions of dollars for their conduct, Leahy told Mueller, I'm not buying this story, that it was all one guy who did this. And there's a substantial body of work, a substantial amount of evidence that it wasn't simply one guy.
While we're on that topic of the anthrax attacks, what resulted from the anthrax attacks?
Yes, that's critical. After the 9/11 attacks, a lot of people felt besieged and traumatized, and this was very adroitly exploited by the Bush-Cheney administration, including the anthrax attacks. People were beside themselves, afraid to open their mail, similar to the dynamic of you have here of people being on edge in a different sort of way, but it's the closest parallel in many respects. Congress was suspended for a time, and Bush-Cheney administration rammed the Patriot Act, so-called Patriot Act, with draconian restrictions on civil liberties and so on during that time. And they also built up their wars against Afghanistan as well as against Iraq.
You've worked for a number of progressive media outlets and media watchdog outlets like Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting. But it seems there's a kind of a new sort of myopia from traditionally progressive venues where a number of issues related to the pandemic are concerned. One of these in particular is the possible laboratory origin of the coronavirus. What explains this attitude? How has this been politicized?
I think part of the answer to that is the sort of dwindling of independent thought in left of center circles coming out of the Russiagate and then Ukrainegate situations, where a lot of people just are so compulsively, quote-unquote, anti-Trump that they aren't sorting out facts and seeing where stories are coming from and who's pushing them. And I think we saw significant sectors of liberal and progressive media become, in effect, implements of the DNC as a result of that process. And I think that it's been in sort of different quarters and in different ways, but similar. You have a process now where people are sort of reflexively saying, we don't want to do anything that will damage U.S.-China relations or that will be used by the pro-war sections, especially of the U.S. right, in terms of China relations. So I think that there's been a tremendous and it doesn't make sense to me because, you know, it's an empirical question to me. And I think that in certain quarters in the mainstream, there has been a hysterical attempt to squash the possibility that it had something to do with the lab. And again, that something could be either it came out of the labs or they're being framed. And I think that there's been an incredible lack of inquisitiveness and honest inquiry on those questions across the political spectrum.
So let's just get down to some of the basics. What is gain of function research? And what is a biosafety level 3 or level 4 lab? Who runs them? Where are they?
Sure. Gain of function research is something of a technical euphemism. It means that you're trying to make it more deadly. So you take a virus, for example, that is deadly but isn't airborne, and you make it so that it becomes airborne. So you have increased its functionality, you've increased its deadliness, and this is presumably a scientific accomplishment. The person who wrote the U.S. implementing legislation for the Biological Weapons Convention, Francis Boyle, calls this criminal, a criminal enterprise. It's similarly derided by an eminent scientist, Richard Ebright, at Rutgers University. There's been periodic concern, even in the mainstream literature, when a scientist in the Netherlands and another one at the University of Wisconsin in 2001 managed to use animal passages. That is, they took a virus and then forced it through several ferrets. Ferrets have a respiratory system that's similar to humans. The New York Times had an editorial called An Engineered Doomsday. Their concern was that it shouldn't be published because then either through lab accident or the terrorists can get a hold of it. Again, they ignore the other option, which is what happened with anthrax, that it came out of the government. Gain of function increases the lethality of pathogens such as these viruses.
And what are biosafety level 3, 2, 3, 4 labs? What do they do and where are they located?
There are probably hundreds of them. I believe that there are at least 70 BSL-3 and BSL-4 labs in the United States. They are the highest with the allegedly the most stringent requirements in terms of airflow, suits that are worn, and so on. They are extremely expensive facilities that deal with deadly pathogens and do this kind of research. They exist increasingly all around the world. I don't think that there exists a definitive list of them. I don't think that there exists a completely definitive requirements as to the conduct, although there's certainly some guidelines. The ones that we know of are government ones. Fort Detrick had an accident just last year. They have a new facility coming online that's apparently the most expensive and largest in the world. But they're also corporate. I'm sure that governments have some that are undeclared.
Are there connections between the different labs throughout the world?
There are, and sometimes it's a cause for concern. After there was some publicity to accidental releases at the CDC facilities and other facilities in 2014, and after the Ebola outbreak in 2014, the U.S. stopped funding this gain-of-function work, the NIH did. But they made exceptions. One of the exceptions that they made involved work done by the University of North Carolina and the virology center in Wuhan, as well as Harvard University.
Gain of function studies continued in those places.
The gain of function studies continued, and there was never a ban on gain of function work. There was simply a pause in funding by the NIH of gain-of-function work, but there were even exceptions to that. And the funding of the lab in Wuhan, done also with USAID.
But isn't NIAID, isn't Fauci's lab involved?
Yes, they granted the exemption for the funding, but the actual money was through USAID, which is basically the State Department. As well as a group called EcoHealth Alliance. And this work was that kind of work, gain-of-function work. So they worked with viruses, with the labs in Wuhan, with U.S. universities, in order to make deadly pathogens potentially more deadly, ostensibly to protect, to say, what are the curveballs that nature can throw at us so that we can be better prepared so that we can fight against them? What are the curveballs that the terrorists can throw at us so that we can be better prepared? That's the ostensible reason, but they've, as we've seen, totally failed in their ostensible purpose. They've succeeded in creating more deadly pathogens, but they haven't succeeded in protecting us.
What is the EcoHealth Alliance? It sounds very nice.
Yeah,
it sounds very crunchy.
Right, exactly. That's the problem with these things. EcoHealth Alliance funded, among other things, this work in Wuhan. For example, they go to these bat caves, collect pathogens, collect deadly things, and then take them to study them, and then they tinker with them. Again, this is ostensibly to prevent a pandemic, but if the labs themselves become a transmission site through which they enter the human population, then they become an accelerant. They become the source of the problem. EcoHealth Alliance funded lab work in Wuhan and elsewhere. They have on their board, on their scientific advisory board, former longtime people, top people at Fort Detrick, for example, the U.S. Main bio, quote-unquote, defense bioweapons facility. They get major funding from Colgate-Palmolive and Johnson & Johnson, which have various interests in deforestation, as well as other factors that could be part of the threat here. And in a way, by trying to find this lab solution to, deforestation and animal farming posing some threats, instead of scaling back those things, they're accelerating another thing, this lab work, which could itself become, regardless of the cause of this pandemic, that work is a total threat.
What is NIAID's role? What is Tony Fauci's role in this?
Well, to the extent that I've been able to determine it, there have been alarms raised by scientists for years. There was a letter in 2005 signed by over 700 scientists to the NIH, basically saying, you're perverting our field here with all of this funding of all of this so-called biodefense work. And biodefense is largely indistinguishable in many cases from biowarfare, because you have to create the weapon in order to figure out how to defend against it, is the logic as it goes. So they've in effect tried to find this loophole, which we can get into, around the legal constraints that should be preventing them from doing this kind of work. So these 700 scientists put out this statement saying, especially since 9/11, since the anthrax attacks, you're, perverting our field with all of this funding. And it was Fauci who responded to that at the time. And he basically said the American people, through their political leadership, that's the Bush-Cheney administration he's talking about, have told us that they want this work done. Now, it can either be done through completely through the Pentagon and other U.S. government agencies, or we can have a seat at the table. So we're going to have
U.S. military agencies, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Or even, the other possibilities are either the CIA or the black budget or the nuclear weapons labs are probably involved in this, or almost certainly involved in this as well. So Fauci basically told these 700 scientists to put up or shut up, and this was the direction that this scientific field was increasingly going to move into. And every year there has been, since 9/11, there's been at least $5 billion spent on this quote-unquote bio defense, generally. Now, I don't know how much of that is gain-of-function work. But biodefense generally, there's been at minimum $5 billion a year. A cardinal rule is stated goals are not actual goals in the political realm. They say that they want to do one set of things, protect the American public against the bad terrorists, when in fact their goals are geopolitical domination and so on. So I think that this is another instance of that.
It's not hard to imagine that this would have created a kind of bioweapons arms race.
Absolutely, and that's totally key. The U.S. got around, allegedly got around, the Bioweapons Convention by saying we're doing this for defensive purposes. There are exemptions in the U.S. law that Francis Boyle wrote and the Bioweapons Convention, but the word defensive isn't in there. It says for peaceful purposes, as Professor Boyle will be very happy to emphasize, that the law that he wrote does not have an exemption for defensive work for exactly this reason. So that they are, quite arguably violating it. But the U.S. did so brazenly. And of course, every other country, including China, including Russia, including the UK, France are the main other countries doing it, Israel as well. But Israel never even signed the Bioweapons Convention. They all got the message that, okay, we can do this exception to the Bioweapons Convention, so we can get around it by just simply claiming that it's for defensive purposes. You know, there's sort of a scientific failure, and there's been a media failure. For example, the president of EcoHealth Alliance was on Democracy Now! Not too long ago, and this was, I believe, April 16th. And this was the first time that Democracy Now!, ostensibly the premier flagship of progressive thought in the United States, shared with their audience that there was a lab in Wuhan that could conceivably have been the cause of the pandemic. They had made one reference to it, I think, on April 6th that said, that credited the lab with discovering the coronavirus, but not ever saying. The notion that the lab was the source was dismissed by USA Today, by the Washington Post, by all these outlets in very snarky, dismissive ways that just simply that even predated but then echoed off a very narrow set of scientists who themselves are largely, like EcoHealth Alliance, involved with this work and that want to dismiss any scrutiny in this area as rumors or a conspiracy theory or, you know, and that to me, it goes against science and legitimate inquiry, and it goes against journalism.
You mentioned a February 2020 letter to the medical journal Lancet. Can you describe its contents and who some of its authors were?
Yeah. That letter was ostensibly to show solidarity with the workers in Wuhan, but it also had a phrase denouncing the conspiracy theories as to the non-natural origin of the pandemic. And again, it was an attempt to shut down debate. And to me, that's totally antithetical to the scientific process. The scientific process should welcome scrutiny and debate on serious questions like this. And then you have a hypothesis and you break the hypothesis and you produce evidence and reasonable argument. They attempted to short circuit all of that by saying, this is, you know, conspiracy stuff. One of the signers of the Lancet letter, Charles Kalischer, the first one listed, they're listed alphabetically, several of them have questionable ties to the government. His is perhaps the most notable. He's been accused by the Cuban government of having spread biowarfare agents in Cuba.
Dengue fever, was it?
Correct. He denies the charge, of course, but it's remarkable that's out there. And others have more subtle ties. Peter Daszak, who's the president of the EcoHealth Alliance, was one of the signatures. Other people who are involved in biodefense, quote-unquote biodefense work, were among the signers. It's quite notable that you have, among the loudest voices, people who have some level of U.S. government connection or other questionable things in their background along these lines, trying to shut down
among the
this
loudest
debate.
Voices denying the possible
denying
lab origin.
The possibility that this had anything to do with any kind of lab work.
You wrote about a piece in the journal Nature Medicine. Who is Robert Gary?
Robert Gary is a very interesting character. He seems to keep popping up at politically convenient locations. He happened to be in West Africa doing lab work when the Ebola outbreak happened there. I found an interview with him with James Carville, the Democratic Party operative, about the Ebola outbreak that was just remarkable for one given by a scientist. It was basically talking about how we really needed to, take care of this Ebola situation because the government most affected by it was an ally of the United States. And therefore, we needed to, you know, back them up because if this continued, then they might be destabilized. It was just a remarkable set of perspectives for a scientist.
I mean, as opposed to just saying we should be dealing with this.
Yeah,
no matter
it wasn't
what.
Dealing in the realm of, caring for regular people, or that seemed secondary at best, or just from a scientific perspective. He's also been noted in his assorted roles by Dr. Merrill Nass, who's done leading work on the anthrax vaccine, where she's noted that he keeps popping up in all of these situations that don't seem connected by a scientific interest. They all seem to be politically charged issues. And Ed Hooper, who wrote The River, a book that alleges that the outbreak of HIV was because of a polio vaccine that had gone wrong in Africa. That was well reviewed in the New York Times when it came out in 1999, I think. He says that Robert Gary acted in completely bizarre fashion with him that seemed more akin to spook work when Hooper was trying to study the origins of the AIDS AIDS epidemic. So several people have raised substantial questions about his role as a scientist.
And what did he, was he a part of this article? What was the article in journal, in the Nature Medicine Journal?
It purported to say that this was not a that the novel coronavirus is not a laboratory construct. But it seemed to have done so simply by saying that it wasn't technically genetically engineered. But as many people have noted, that those two things are not the same. It can come out of a lab without necessarily being genetically engineered. So it was a very disingenuous, at best, article, if not outright false. And then it was immediately picked up by all of these media outlets, USA Today, ABC, Washington Post, so on and so forth, with, you know, the snarkiest headlines and, you know, these scientists are getting tired of debunking this crazy conspiracy theory, that entire...
Yeah, it wasn't ABC News headline, sorry, conspiracy theorists, there's
right,
no
right.
lab origin, okay?
Right, yeah. ABC had that snarky headline, and then I can't remember, some other outlet said, the scientists are tired of debunking these theories,
And you mentioned someone named Lori Garrett. Who's Lori Garrett, and what did she write?
She's very prominent on this issue. She has written several books about potential pandemics. She used to be with the Council on Foreign Relations.
Is she a scientist?
She's not a scientist. She's a journalist. She's a writer. And one time she did this outright, wants to blame, quote-unquote, exotic animals for the outbreak. And at one point...
Like the consumption of exotic animals?
Correct, as that being the way that it went from bats to humans. It just seemed very odd to me that that's the constant refrain in these quarters. She's associated with Ian Lipkin from Columbia University. They were both... special technical advisors to the movie Contagion that millions, if not tens of millions of people have viewed, especially lately. And, the movie depicts unregulated lab work at a BSL-3 as a heroic enterprise that helps to stop the contagion. And it depicts the CDC as, you know, led by very caring, although flawed, individuals. It depicts the Army fairly positively, and indeed it gives thanks to the Pentagon as well as the CDC. And it was funded by the state of Georgia, which is where the CDC is located.
What's the overall impression one gets from Contagion?
The overall impression that one gets from Contagion is that unregulated lab work can be heroic, and that the threat is deforestation and animal farming. And animals, you know, that bats, that's how the movie ends. It's transmitted from a bat to a pig that a chef touches, and then he shakes hands with an American woman who jumps on a plane and heads to the United States, and that's how the outbreak fundamentally begins.
But interestingly, what we've been learning from virologists and what I'm sure you've been seeing in your work, to actually make the leap from just a pig to a bat to a human, it requires much more gain of function than just that. To do that sort of thing, we've discovered might take hundreds of years for it to kind of happen naturally. But it's just the sort of work that's being done in these labs to artificially create that situation, which may not even ever happen ordinarily.
The thing that we can't avert our eyes from is that it effectively accelerates the existence and the proximity to humans of the threat.
And these, in other words, some of the threats that they've developed might never have naturally occurred had they not done the work.
Correct. That's my understanding. That they are out to look for enemies, ostensibly for the purpose of figuring out how to defeat them.
And sounds like a common refrain.
That's at best a very dangerous thing. I mean, you have Richard Ebright, an eminent scientist, and he calls this kind of work that they do, going to these caves, and he says it's not science, it's Indiana Jones adventurism. It's the definition of insanity, he calls it. And you hear that phrase quite a bit. A former head of the Royal Scientific Society in 2014 called this kind of work incredibly dangerous and crazy, this gain-of-function work.
You quote Lord May, who's the former president of the Royal Society, as saying, the work they are doing is absolutely crazy. The whole thing is exceedingly dangerous. Yes, there is a danger, but it's not rising from the viruses out there in the animals. It's rising from the labs of grossly ambitious people.
Yeah, I mean, I think specifically he was talking there about the work that was done in Holland and the work that was done at the University of Wisconsin on the making the bird flu more easily transmissible. But I think that same charge applies to the work that we're seeing in Wuhan and the associated work in the United States by these people who are incredibly well-funded. I mean, EcoHealth Alliance gets a lot of money from corporations and through the U.S. government and so on, and they are, although they just recently got cut off from some U.S. government funding, but they had a full spread in the New York Times basically saying, we're the solution, fund us more. I think grossly ambitious people fits the bill here.
Who is Ron Fouchier?
Sure. Ron Fouchier is a scientist in the Netherlands who used NIH funding to make the bird flu more deadly, to make it transmissible through the air. This caused a furor. Or not a furor, but it got some notice in 2011 or so. It was, I believe that he outright said, you know, he proudly said that he's created the most deadly pathogen yet. A lot of people said that he shouldn't publish the results. They eventually were published.
Does this essentially provide some kind of a roadmap to people about how to make something like this?
Right. The work that he did was using ferrets to passage a virus through a series of ferrets, in this case the bird flu, until it became transmissible by air so that it would mutate until it acquired that capacity and would be able to infect humans. So he made something that was deadly, far more transmissible, and therefore far, far deadlier. And this caused some concern in various quarters, but not enough to actually stop this work from being done. He was, you know, Francis Boyle would call him and many of these other people death scientists.
Who are Mark Lipsitch and Allison P. Galvani, and what did they write regarding Fouché's work in 2014? I'll just give you this quote. "We argue that the two main benefits claimed for these experiments, improved vaccine design and improved interpretation of surveillance, are unlikely to be achieved by the creation of potential pandemic pathogens, PPP, often termed gain-of-function experiments." Who are these guys and what were they trying to accomplish?
They're scientists at Yale and Harvard, and they have been some of the people who are sometimes vocal on this issue and cautioning against this kind of extremely dangerous lab work. I believe that I've seen some media by at least one of them since our current pandemic, but not on this issue. There's the loud crowd of people who are part of doing this dangerous work, and they're very loudly denouncing any effort to scrutinize it. But you have, I think, a lot of scientists who are very careful people for whatever reason, either if they're cautious by nature or they don't want to go against where a lot of government funding is being done. And they're remarkably quiet on this very question. So the media mantra that there's scientific consensus that this didn't come out of a lab is not true. A lot of the most prominent scientists, people who we talked about at Harvard and Yale, as well as, for example, Jonathan King at MIT, have been notably silent as to what the cause for the current pandemic is.
But prior to this, they had been sounding the warning.
To some extent. It's periodic. The only person really sounding the warning on a regular basis is Francis Boyle. And to some extent, Richard E. Bright and a few others. But a lot of these, you know, names at more prestigious institutions, for again whatever reasons, have denounced the work in some set of circumstances, but not nearly as regularly and less frequently as the years go by, whether that's because the field is changing because of the funding priorities as implemented by Fauci and others or for other reasons, is somewhat speculative, but that's certainly the dynamic.
Now, there have been journalists who've covered this. Who is Allison Young and what was her beat?
Allison Young worked at USA Today, and from, I believe, 2014 to 2017, she wrote a series of articles about lab accidents in the United States at the CDC, at how they are shrouded in secrecy, at Tulane, at facilities in Tulane, I believe at Fort Detrick, at dozens of facilities around the United States. She would go through the government reports. She would do other investigative work. It prompted some level of congressional inquiry at the time. She really performed a substantial service. She's no longer on that beat. She stopped around 2017. And she's off doing something else now at some university, and she's not, I've touched base with her, but she's not, you know, doing anything on this.
Who is Meryl Nass, and what is her role been, and what's her work been prior to this?
Meryl Nass, she, as far as I know, documented did the first work documenting a case of biowarfare in recent decades. It involved Rhodesia and the use of anthrax there by the white minority government or elements associated with it against black farmers. She's the first person who I heard from about the problems with the Nature Medicine article. She pointed out that it was an incredibly disingenuous article, and there were a whole series of ways that, besides genetic engineering, that the current pandemic could have resulted. That was shared with Richard Ebright at Rutgers, and he said, yeah, he totally backed that up and said, for example, you could do animal passage as they did in Holland and the University of Wisconsin.
So we've been talking about gain of function and how that possibility has been minimized, but Luc Montagnier made a very startling claim recently. And if you could just tell us who Luc Montagnier is and what he discovered, and what is he now suggesting is the case about the novel coronavirus?
Luc Montagnier won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering the HIV virus. And he recently has said that he believes that the current novel coronavirus is genetically engineered and that it has elements of HIV and other elements in it that are recognizable. This is remarkably similar to what Francis Boyle has been saying since late January or early February.
But Montagnier actually says he's looked at it.
He says that he's looked at it. I believe that he's basing some of his assessment on some work done by some Indian scientists who pulled back their work. He says that it was done for political reasons under pressure, which also has been alleged about some Chinese scientists who put out some statements early on saying that the lab in Wuhan was responsible. They also withdrew their statements. Montagnier says, I'm a Nobel winner. They can't intimidate me, and this is my assessment. I don't believe that he's published a clear scientific paper as to the methodology behind his assessments.
And he's not saying it necessarily came from Wuhan. He's just saying, look, I've found HIV edited into this.
Yes, that my understanding is that he is adamant in not drawing any kind of conclusions other than I believe that this was human creation.
How many lab accidents did you run across? Was there a long list of them?
There's a very long list of them. There was a paper, a version of which was published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists in 2014 that went back in time. Lab accidents in England, foot and mouth disease, other that happened 4 kilometers away from a biosafety lab. Assorted other things that happened throughout the years and again through the reporting of USA Today. We're talking about hundreds of accidents.
That we know about.
And the literature says that this could well be the tip of the iceberg. These are the things that get reported. These are the things that see the light of day. So we don't know what else is out there that has happened and that has been either ignored or hushed up. I mean, a lot of lab accidents, they might not even know. I mean, the lab accident in Wuhan, if it came out of a lab in Wuhan, could just somebody didn't take quite the proper precaution they could have, and they wouldn't know that they made a mistake and somehow a pathogen got out of the lab. That's perfectly plausible.
Is the answer given the safety problems, and given that their research seems to be spurring a kind of arms race, a bioweapons arms race, and given that we are artificially accelerating dangers that we might not ever need face, Is your answer in looking all this to really dismantle these biodefense labs? I mean, is that where we as a people should be agitating for?
I think at minimum there should be a stop on the gain of function work. And there was a pause in funding from 2014 to 2017. It was lifted in 2017. That was just a pause in funding. I think what needs to stop is the actual gain of function work, at least until a proper assessment is made. And again, it presumably violates the Bioweapons Convention. So those conventions need to have genuine teeth put into them. Now, I don't know what other portions of biodefense work are good and relevant. I think that there needs to be a much broader inquiry about that. But at least in dealing with these potentially pandemic pathogens, what's euphemistically known as gain of function work, I think that work should be stopped. Francis Boyle would probably go further and say that people involved in that need to be prosecuted. And I think a broader assessment needs to be done about what if any elements of biodefense work are legitimate.
So once the cat is out of the bag, could you ever even stuff it back in? You were talking about regulation, you were talking about we need to know more. But we could stop this all, theoretically say it has to stop, but people know how to do it. So can you ever really stop it?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because people used to talk about biological and chemical weapons as the examples of people having succeeded in putting the cat back in the bag. And it seems that didn't happen, that it just simply morphed into a whole set of pretexts. So ultimately, the problems are questions of partially of science and partially of media and getting information out, but largely of global governance, of what meaningful implements you can use to stop these sorts of dynamics of these governments accelerating these weapons arms race. And sometimes it's a mutually beneficial thing. I mean, when I got kicked out in Helsinki, my question was about the nuclear weapons ban treaty. This is a treaty backed by 122 countries. The group behind it won the Nobel Peace Prize. And Trump was never asked about it. To my knowledge, Putin was never asked about it, about why are you stopping this? And they're stopping it because that's how they derive their power, by having these weapons. That's how the United States government derives a great deal of geopolitical power, and that's how Russia derives a great deal of geopolitical power. And so they enter into this dance of death that effectively, you know, pushes down other people. And you could have a very similar dynamic now with bioweapons.
Okay, my final question. Given all the happy outcomes for state and monopoly power all over the world, including massive wealth transfer upwards, shuttering of small business, the repression of dissent, et cetera, and given, I have to say, what appears to be the foreknowledge on display in oddly prescient international exercises like Event 201.
It began in healthy-looking pigs months, perhaps years ago. A new coronavirus spread silently within herds. Infected people got a respiratory illness with symptoms ranging from mild flu-like signs to severe pneumonia.
Governments need to be willing to do things that are out of their historical perspective, or for the most part, it's really a war footing that we need to be on.
So at the moment, we want the funds, right? You need the money. So where's the money? But now you need a really coordinated, centralized efforts.
Is it not probable that this virus was indeed, you know, I won't say use the word engineered, but was released not necessarily by any one country, but really for the mutual benefit of powerful groups in every country?
Whitney Webb, a journalist at Last American Vagabond, who her work, as well as other interesting work on this, has been either deplatformed or demonetized by the internet giants, has done some interesting work on this, laying out that there were war games or some kind of preparatory games before the current pandemic that were eerily similar to Dark Winter, which was immediately before and foreshadowed the anthrax attacks in 2001. I think it's very difficult for me to assess probabilities in something like this. I think that what we do know is that a lot of very powerful institutions benefited tremendously from this pandemic, and that a lot of agendas around remaking society in various ways benefited. This so-called social distancing, which shouldn't, you know, it's physical distancing, presumably. But it's been a boon to internet companies, to other powerful forces, to nationalistic forces. To some extent, they could be simply fortune favors the prepared, or that it was actually planned by one or more interests involved. I think that it's disingenuous for people to say, as I've heard many people say, oh, this isn't what a bioweapon looks like, so that can't be right. Well, you don't know what a bioweapon looks like. It's something that hurts people and is used for strategic purpose.
Are they saying that because this is too weak somehow?
This is either too weak or too unpredictable. Some of these things have merit. I mean, Boris Johnson allegedly got it, so you'd think that whoever did this might have wanted to give him a heads up. I'm not seeing clear delineations on these issues, but I think that the notion that this is either too weak or that it's too unpredictable, and therefore it can't possibly be an intentionally created bioweapon, I don't think that's a really rigorous statement. You don't know what the intended goals are of a given bioweapon until it benefits certain parties. So I think that all three of those three options are still possible. And I would challenge people who want to dismiss this to go back and wonder why you didn't ask the questions about the anthrax attacks. Why didn't you ask the questions at the time? And why didn't you ask the questions as the so-called investigations, went forward? And Robert Mueller effectively had a hand in covering it up, and then he's brought back to guide the direction of the Democratic Party for 3 years. There's such an insular clique of individuals involved in this, and such a lack of scrutiny by a lot of parties that I seriously question attempts to dismiss such possibilities.
What's this whole idea about trying to blame nature for these things? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it's part of a whole search for enemies. It's Iraq is the problem, Al Qaeda is the problem. Well, you created Al Qaeda by funding the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviets. Well, this is the problem. It's North Korea. It's this and that. Well, North Korea voted for the nuclear weapons ban treaty. You voted against it. There's a search for enemies, and in some respects, the final enemy is nature, of saying it's these, or culture. It's these weird people eating weird meats, and that therefore that's the problem, or nature, and we have to control nature. That it has to succumb to our will, that views humanity not as a creation of nature that needs to play off of it and build off of it and learn from it and work in harmony with it, but rather needs to control and manipulate it for geostrategic, for profit, for gain, for things, and only maybe tangentially for genuine benefit of humanity.